Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, June 9th, 2011. And first of all, welcome to many new fans. Every week there are many new people listening to this show. And I appreciate that. The fans are what make this show possible and what make it fun for me. But at any rate, I have a somewhat humorous story to tell tonight about getting ready for this particular show. Once, many of you may remember, I was at a resort out in the middle of nowhere once, and I was late. I was just racing to get to a room at this resort, and there was no one there, and I pull in right in front of the door where the room where I'm staying, and I park, and I go running in, and I set up, and so at any rate, to make a long story short, I started doing the show, and all of a sudden, one of the groundkeepers comes up, starts pounding on the door, saying, I have to move my vehicle. And so at any rate, that went on, and anyway, that was one story. But tonight, this one tops that one. Tonight, I'm in the middle of nowhere. I have my remote studio with me, but I was not able to get, I'm far away from my home studio, and so I'm searching for a place where I can get a good enough radio signal to connect to the station to do the show. So I finally do that, and I pull into what appears to be a vacant parking lot, nobody around, and I'm all set up, and I got all my equipment ready and tuned in, and I made a couple contacts, radio contacts, to make sure that my signal was strong enough to get to the station in Nashville. And I'm sitting there all ready to go, and all of a sudden a guy comes out of the house that's kind of off a little bit in the distance and starts doing chainsaw art. What is the probability of that happening? So I had to quick move and reset up everything, and this was what is the probability that you would park next to somebody that would come out right before I start the show and start doing chainsaw art? Anyway, so I am here. I'm here live tonight and very thankful to be here. Tonight's main science topic, I will be talking about some Planet X type events that happened hundreds of millions of years ago on Earth. And many people talk about Planet X as a recent event, 3,600-year alleged orbit. I don't say that. Other people do. But there is evidence of some repetitive cycle for something recently coming through the solar system. Many times people confuse this with the Venus event, where Venus was a large comet, came through this, was captured by Jupiter, moved through the solar system, encountered Mars, encountered Earth. We know this because of the ancients telling us so. And then eventually that large comet settled into the orbit where we now see Venus. But at any rate, the point is that I went back in history and I had did some traveling this past week, ended up at a place called Niagara Falls, up in the Canadian side of the Niagara Falls, a very touristic place. Tourism is might be called the epitome, the ultimate in tourism activity, Niagara Falls. And so, but of course, my mind was not so much in looking at the falls, the spectacular one of the seven wonders of the world, but I was more interested in looking at the layers along the shoreline where the this tremendous falls and river cascades through a cavern. I was more interested in looking at the rocks and geology. And what we see there is, well, anyway, that's going to be the main science topic, so I'm not going to go into that, but I want to talk about some things that are very obvious from the geology of that area. First of all, a quick commentary. E. coli in Europe, many radio shows have covered this topic, but I wanted to give a little bit different twist. For people who may not have heard the whole story about a week ago, E. coli, in fact, I mentioned this on my show. As soon as I heard about this, I knew that this was a government military soup kitchen variety of virus. Or the E. coli is something that grows on typically human waste and is a very, very poisonous, of course, and it's sometimes found in food. But then they pointed the finger at a group in Spain that was growing bean sprouts, organic bean sprouts. And, of course, this had a number of goals. Of course, they are trying to damage the natural food industry. And, of course, everybody immediately is waiting for these people to do this kind of activity. So, and then they had to come out and say this was not the source of the E. coli. But then the investigation stopped. Well, wouldn't you think that the health organizations should go ahead and continue to investigate and see where this really came from? But, of course, they're linked to the government. It's a very clearly a government operation with the nutcases that run our government military bio labs. But the twist I wanted to talk about here is the science of creating resistant strains that can only be done with extremely well-equipped and well-supplied laboratories. And so I wanted to talk about the science of how they do this and why it could only be done at a facility. Now, other companies would have an interest in this, say the drug companies, the pharmaceuticals, the food corporations that have an interest in drowning out organic, non-GMO type food. But at any rate, how do you create a resistant, a drug resistance or an antibiotic resistance strain? And here's how it's done. For example, E. coli is a common bacteria that grows on, it can be found basically all over the world. And of course, how do you keep it out of food? You just have to have clean food processing. You cannot use human waste for fertilizers. That's one rule number one, of course. But the E. coli bacteria is something that's widely known, and it typically can be dealt with certain types of antibacterial drugs. Tetracycline was one of the first ones used, and there's a whole laundry list of newer, more powerful penicillin-type drugs, etc., that can be used against E. coli. But the strain that was released into the food chain in Europe this past week was resistant to all of the standard antibacterial types of drugs. So how does one create that? Obviously, this had to be a created strain, something that was created in a laboratory. But how do they do this? Here's what happens. You take standard E. coli that you could find on the city street, any place in the world, and now you take and culture this. And this is, as I describe this process, you're going to understand that this can only be done in a very well-equipped laboratory. It's not something that some crazy guy does in his basement. But at any rate, you take an average strain of E. coli, you culture it under extremely pure conditions so that there's no other bacteria. It's the only bacteria being cultured, and then you introduce, let's start with tetracycline, one of the very early the antibiotics that was used against bacteria or various types of infections a long time ago. Okay, now you wait. You inject the tetracycline into the growth medium, and you allow the E. coli to grow. So the point is that when the strain evolves that is resistant to tetracycline, you take that off and put it aside, and you start to culture that particular version of E. coli. Then, okay, now that's growing. You get that growing in a healthy environment, and then you introduce the next antibiotic that would be you want to create a resistance. And there's kind of a method for doing this. You introduce some antibiotics, and then you take the culture away and let it adjust, and then you put in that same antibiotic again. So you see, this is not a simple one-time process. And this is, by the way, why doctors will tell you that if, say, you're taking a drug or a medication, you have to finish it, because if you don't, and the bacteria or whatever you're trying to fight comes back, it learns how to be resistant to that particular drug. So you're teaching a strain, for example, like E. coli, to become resistant. But that's what they do. They have to introduce some of that drug, let the E. coli grow, and then they remove that antibiotic, and then they let the culture grow again. They keep doing this, kind of pulsing in and out the antibacteria. And then they finally give it a good dose of the antibiotic, and then the culture that remains in that, they remove and set up a new culture. Then they bring in and do the same thing with the next antibiotic. And this has to be done over a very long period of time under very precise conditions. So as you can see, this is not something that you can do in your basement. It's under highly controlled conditions, under highly isolated conditions. And so finally, after you have grown an E. coli that is resistant to all of the current antibiotics known, then what they did is they took it over and released it into the food chain, putting it into apparently this organic bean sprouts, and then trying to point the finger at this company in Spain saying that they were the cause of this. Well, it became very clear that that was not the cause of the E. coli found in Germany. But many people died, many people are sick, thousands of people are sick, and they have kidney damage, they have other serious body damage because of this. Even though they didn't die, they're still going to be very weakened, they're going to be very sick. And so the point is that the investigation has been sidetracked, stonewalled, stopped, where it should be looking, and they should be going after the people in these laboratories. But you see how crazy the world is today. Okay, I'm going to move on to another topic here. Many weeks running, I have been talking about the Japanese pollution, talking about different aspects, how you should be how this pollution comes to the United States in the jet stream, in the air, then rains out in certain areas, and how the U.S. and Canadian monitoring stations have been shut off, and how this is being once again stonewalled as a topic that should be studied, how the various oceanographic institutes are making a study, assuming that it is a non-harmful pollution, and using it just to measure ocean currents. How ridiculous. Well, at any rate, here's what came up this week, and I did some studying and some calculations. Let's examine the Pacific whale fleet, if you want to call it, or the life of whales in the Pacific. The Japanese radiation, the pollution that was dumped directly into the ocean, and what wasn't dumped directly into the ocean was later washed into the ocean after the typhoon 1 week ago blew over Japan and dumped a tremendous amount of water onto Japan. That radiation has now moved off into the Pacific and is moving eastward across the Pacific Ocean. The statement by the various oceanographic institutes is this is harmless and that it will become diluted. I talked about this on previous shows, so I'm not going to go into detail on that aspect, that they're trying to pawn this off as being something that will be diluted and no problem. But what I emphasized is this is accumulation, it's a cumulative pollution, and it will end up in the food chain, just as mercury ends up in the food chain in the freshwater, especially in freshwater locations or any place where there's, say, wood processing or paper processing plants. That mercury becomes, it gets into the water table, into the, and then fish become polluted with it because they're in the food chain. Okay, now, as the plankton in the Pacific Ocean filter the water through their cells and accumulate the radiation. Most of that seawater, as it crosses the Pacific Ocean, that polluted seawater is going to be filtered by plankton. And that plankton then will be consumed by the small sea life that the whales eat. Here is my prediction. And it's very difficult to say exactly, but within 2 to 3 years, due to the dumping of radiation into the ocean, the whale population of the Pacific Ocean could be drastically affected because they are so connected with the small sea life. That's what whales eat. They filter it through that's why they have that big mouth. They open it up and they collect vast amounts of whatever's in the ocean. It comes in. It's like a big salad for the whales. But what's going to happen is within one cycle. Now, the typical way these types of pollutants, mercury or radiation, work their way up through the food chain into salmon or tuna, for example, they go through many iterations through the smaller sea life up until the tuna or the salmon. But with the whales, that's kind of like a direct drive system. As they swim through those Pacific waters and they go up to Alaska, as they come down and they feed up by Alaska, all of that water will be polluted with the nuclear pollution from Japan. They will be accumulating that into their fat, into their cells, and that will affect the whales directly within 2 to 3 years. We're going to see a drastic effect on the whale population in the Pacific. So anyway, I just wanted to make that clear that as the United States and Canada and other countries and Japan turn their backs on this problem, as they continue to try and sell nuclear power around the world, the Pacific whale fleet, if you want to call it that, is tremendously at risk. Okay, the Chilean volcanoes have been going off with somewhat regularity. There have been 3 major eruptions in the past couple of years. Another one this past week, and I hope to be putting some photos up. You can actually see these on the internet, but a tremendous amount of electrical activity over the Chilean volcanoes, the lightning. And how does this happen? I just should mention here that when I first started the posting these pictures, I put them on my webpage. There, my 30-year poster has a beautiful picture of one of the Chilean volcanoes a couple years ago. I took that poster to one of the American Geophysical Union meetings that I attend regularly, and within a short amount of time, Standard Science had to pick up the banner and formed groups that now study volcanic electricity within Standard Science. But of course, their story is that this is generated in the clouds above the volcano. And of course, what's really going on is the plume above the volcano is like an electrical finger pointing up towards the ionosphere. It's the same mechanism that Tesla towers use, but it's much higher, of course. And the ionosphere discharges into this column of smoke and ash, and that's why you see this tremendous, unbelievable lightning that surrounds and shooting out of the plume. Now, if the electricity were formed inside the plume, it would never leave the plume. It would simply discharge within the plume. But you see the lightning shooting out across the sky to other clouds, to the ground, tens of miles away. How does this happen? There's no battery on the planet that will have electricity shoot out of it. Automatically, batteries try to discharge within themselves first, unless there's an electrical circuit that's created that is much easier to get through. And so it's very clear that the electricity, that the volcanic plume is simply a small portion of the overall electrical circuit. So anyway, I hope to have some of those posted. I've been a little bit behind on postings on the page just because I've been had a very poor internet connection, and due to being on the road the last couple of days. But at any rate, I hope to have those posted on my webpage shortly. A number of weeks ago, when the extremely powerful weather was occurring in the United States, I made a prediction. I said this weather will start to subside around June 10th. Well, we're there about now, and I said that the reason for this amazingly powerful weather, these weather systems, now some of these could have been manipulated, and it's very difficult to tell when you have this kind of power going on in the atmosphere. But I said there was an electrical alignment in the solar system, a very unusual one, which did not include Earth. It was Mercury, Venus, Mars, and Jupiter had an electrical alignment for a short period of time. And Mercury, of course, moves very quickly out of this alignment, but it left Venus, Mars, and Jupiter very tightly coupled. And, of course, when this happens, then electrical, by the way, this electrical alignment just happened to be within the August return current sheet of Earth, and that's something I talk about in my books, the explanation of how this return current sheet works as part of the electrical circuit of the Sun. But at any rate, Mercury, Venus, Mars, and Jupiter had a perfect electrical alignment, and therefore they were discharging this solar capacitor and causing the Sun to have some very booming flaring activity. This affected Earth. Now, we've seen many times where comets will come in, cause a solar flare, and affect Earth weather. We've seen in the last couple weeks two comets come in and cause extremely large solar flares. And of course, standard science has to, in a very sing-song nursery rhyme manner, have to deny it and call it coincidence. But anyway, as this weather developed due to the Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter electrical alignment, I said that around June 10th, this weather would start to subside. And that's exactly what has happened. So once again, weather can be predicted if you know what causes the weather. But you look and see, as I've said before, that the National Weather Service and its associated bureaus and agencies don't know what causes the weather, so they have no idea why any of this is happening. They can't predict it. They just talk about the end results. It's kind of the police after a robbery. They go and fill out some paperwork, but they really don't prevent any crime. They're just filling out pieces of paper after the fact, so to speak. So, at any rate, that seems to be happening. And the thing that followed on the tail of this for the last few days, tremendous winds from the south bringing 100-plus degree weather to the northern states. This tremendous, record-breaking hot streak of 2 or 3 days. Most people are going, where did this come from? About a week ago, we were worried about it snowing. And so all of a sudden we have 100-degree weather. Now it's cooling down. It's nearly 50 degrees in many parts of the upper Midwest. Crazy, crazy weather. I wanted to talk again about the Caribbean weather. A number of weeks ago, I thought to myself, I want to go someplace. I want to just take a little trip, just take it easy, just go someplace. And, of course, where I was in the upper Midwest, the weather conditions were horrific. So I thought, there's got to be some place where I can just go and I can either fly there, I can drive there, I can do something to get to some place where there's calm, sunny weather. And I wanted to, so I looked. I started looking around the United States. I looked in the Caribbean. I looked all over and literally was unable to find any place on the planet. I looked in China, not that I was going to go to China. I looked all over. There was not a single place on the planet where you could go and anticipate more than a couple hours of decent weather. And in the process, I was studying the Caribbean weather, something I'm very familiar with. The Caribbean weather has the trade winds coming in from the northeast. The Caribbean typically has very constant trade winds unless there's a hurricane rolling through. But now what's going on is the storm systems, which have been extreme, to say the least, coming across Africa. And as they roll off the western leg of Africa, they typically will roll out into the Atlantic and start, maybe 10 degrees north latitude, rolling westerly, straight west, or maybe moving a little bit north. Now, these same storms are rolling off, dipping southward, some of them down towards the equator, some of them even south of the equator, which is extremely unusual, and rolling into South America, where they're just getting pummeled with heavy, heavy flooding. Many regions of Venezuela, Colombia, Ecuador, and of course through Central America being absolutely flooded, many regions being isolated. I've heard of some areas where 60 to 70 bridges that connect into these areas have been washed out. So there's areas that are completely, completely isolated. No communication, no ability to get in or out, to get help or supplies into these people. So it's completely unknown the status of many of these people. That's the crazy Caribbean weather. Then these storm systems, some of them are apart, the northern portion will roll north and start hitting Cuba and the Dominican Republic, Haiti, Puerto Rico, and the Antilles Islands. And they'll be coming in from the west, completely diametrically opposed to the standard trade winds that would be in this area during this particular time of year. So the crazy Caribbean weather continues. I'll be continuing to talk about the weather as this very strange year continues. And of course the typhoon moving into Japan, I talked about that being potentially a manipulated storm. If you look at the standard path for typhoons, they move through the Pacific. Many of them move into Southeast Asia, into China, the coastal China, but many of them will swing north or even northeast up the China coast and into the region around Japan. But the typhoons rarely actually hit Japan. They will swing east and move in an easterly direction, but this last one stayed right on track until it rolled right over Japan. And I tried to find historical precedent for that type of typhoon pattern, and I could not. So was that storm manipulated? Was that part of our friends, the same ones that would put E. coli into the food chain, killing hundreds of people, making thousands of other people sick? Would that be the same group of people or their friends causing that kind of damage to follow up with the Japanese the meltdown of those reactors in Japan? By the way, and I wanted to mention this too, I forgot, it was not in my notes, but it crossed my mind, I was thinking about the E. coli issue, that the E. coli issues, also, there's another factor here, and I know people, if I know there's children listening to this show, but I think it's important so people understand what's going on. There is evidence that this type of E. coli strain could not be developed without human experimentation. In other words, the use of human beings as guinea pigs to develop that strain of E. coli. In other words, one that is also the human immune system cannot deal with. It wouldn't do much good to develop an E. coli that migrated into something that your immune system could fight off naturally. And that would be an unknown. And if you were a good soup kitchen military medical specialist, a doctor in these type of developments, you would understand that at the end product you would have to test it on humans to make sure it did not evolve into something that humans could readily fight off with their natural the natural immune system of the human species. So at any rate, ultimately there would have to be human experimentation. And this is where it gets very sick. These people, it's just something that has to be stopped. If you outline the things on this planet that have to be stopped, the banking system at the heart of it all, the people that create the world wars, the people that make sure that the population is kept down, the people that own science and scientists, as in the case of the E. coli, some scientists had to develop this. They have to work in laboratories. Someone has to fund those laboratories. Someone has to take that out and put it into the food supply. All of this has to be done by workers. So, and it all is a top-down chain of command from the world banking community. That's where the money starts. That's where the blame has to go. And so to unravel this insanity that is running around the world today and take it off the streets once and for all, that's where it has to start. I wanted to list a number of things also. We have a problem with water. There's not a water shortage in the world. It's a water management problem. We don't have a food shortage problem in the world. We have a food management problem centered around the giant food corporation conglomerates, Monsanto, Cargill, etc. We have energy problem. We don't really have an energy problem. We have an energy management problem. We don't have a communications problem in this world. We have a communications management problem. We don't have transportation problems in the world. We have transportation management problems. I've talked about the telecom mess, and I'll be continuing with discussions of that in upcoming shows, that the United States has an absolute mess in the telecommunications industry. People are paying vast amounts of money for telecommunication that is ridiculously poor. My experience tonight was just a small example. How can you have a country with many, many, many different vendors out there and not having continuous coverage? When the breakup of AT&T was implemented decades ago, there was one thing that was supposed to be clear. There had to be interconnectability. In other words, these independent companies, if they couldn't cover a certain area, they had to allow their customers the ability to interconnect. Remember that AT&T split up occurred before cell phone technology became commonplace. And so we have a whole different world today. The telecommunications mess amounts to, very simply, the public having very poor service, paying a tremendous amount of money, and having many companies. Just look at a cell tower, a location where there are many cell towers. You have five or six different companies with cell towers with their antennas on that building. What a tremendous waste of and replication of services. And you're paying for that. So your cost for your service is spread over. If you consolidated this and made these companies work together, then you could pick your own company, but you would have a consolidation of services and you wouldn't be paying five or six times what the cost of telecommunications should be. There should be a national mandate for public interconnectability, but it's simply gone by the wayside because the companies are competing against each other. And nobody's, you have the fox guarding the hen house. If you look at the list I made, water, food, energy, communications, transportation, these are major things that allow our country to prosper. All of them have been taken over by special interest groups, and the government is part of the problem because the special interest groups are running the agencies which are supposed to be overseeing these. And so at any rate, I'll talk about that in future shows. Now I'm going to, let me see if I've got some other, oh, I want to do a quick update on some of the items on the webs, the secure web ordering page. Recently, last week, I've had 50 cases of Mountain House food that I had available to me, and I announced on the show a couple weeks ago. I would be expecting these small allotments of Mountain House food. This is in the number 10 cans. That's the coffee, the large coffee can size cans. And this is the Mountain House freeze-dried food, the good stuff. And I would get occasional allotments of cases of these, and they would be very specific items. I would be posting them on my homepage. I got access to and had in the warehouse 50 cases of the, it's a, called the 60-day meat veggie unit. In other words, it's six cans, a couple cans of meat, a couple cans of veggies, and enough for one person for 60 days. Very good supply of food, and $210 for a case of six cans. I had 50 of these cases, and they were posted on the webpage. They sold out over the first weekend, and then I got access to another 25 cases, which are still, some are still available. So if you're interested in this, go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, and those should be gone very shortly. But keep an eye on the webpage, because I will be getting individual small lots of cases. And that's all I will sell. I'm not selling a can at a time. I'm selling six cans in a case, in a cardboard case. And those will be posted as they come available, as they are in the warehouse. So these will be in the warehouse, ready to ship. And so some of those 60-day meat and veggie units still remain at the time of this show. Those should be gone soon. But then also, I'll be posting other items as I get them. Maybe it'll be 10 cases. Maybe it'll be 15 cases. Whatever is available, I'll post on the webpage. Just keep going back there to see what's available. The pre-filters are still in stock. We're just barely keeping ahead of orders on those, but we're keeping our head above water just due to fairly good planning. We lost a little for those that ordered around or a little bit before the holiday. We lost about a week of time there due to shipping over the holiday. And so I apologize for that. It just, we're regaining ground and getting everything up to date. So, but the pre-filters are in stock. The books, all of them are in being reprinted right now, and we still have some stock left. So at any rate, and some people have been waiting for the Calculate Primes book. That's coming out shortly, the latest reprinting of that book. So I appreciate everybody's patience as far as the ordering goes. When I started this radio show over a decade ago, and I remember selling the Planet X book. It became an international bestseller overnight, and it's still selling. It's still a very popular book, Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes, and it gives you the central core concepts of how the solar system works, and it's a book that's, I forget, it's in its eighth or ninth, it's going into its ninth printing, I believe. And so it's a book that has just sold and sold. And when I write books, they are for all time. It's not like they're only good for a certain portion of time. They're good for all time, and these books are proving that out. Just a quick note on foods and crops. Just my personal observations of going around the United States recently. The food crops are in very, they're just bad, bad, bad. Many places have not been able to plant due to the flooding, due to cold weather. The crops that have been planted, very sparse, very poor. Another thing that's happening around the country due to the the immunization, so to speak, of weeds towards the herbicides that are used by the big food corporations and the seed corporations. The same situation as with E. coli, these weeds are becoming resistant to the herbicides that are used by farmers. And so you're starting to see farmers' fields with weeds that cannot be controlled. So organic farming is what you worked for. Organic farming worked for thousands of years. Modern farming methods do not work. They have a short lifespan. And once the weeds learn how to grow in spite of the herbicides, it's all over. There are super weeds out there that cannot be killed, and once they start taking over, they won't be able to be stopped. So a tremendous amount of damage being done by the big corporate giants that are trying to control food, water, energy, communications, transportation. All of this could, this world could be such a wonderful place. Imagine, as I said before, if the instead of fighting World War II, they dug the trenches from the Mississippi River, flowing outwards, taking that floodwater out into the Southwest, and where Arizona is burning up now because it is so dry, and we have flooding down the central states to the point where people are leaving their homes because of flooding. How ridiculous. How bad can anybody manage a country with such wealth and prosperous resources? It's just been completely mismanaged. Imagine those big mines up in Minnesota, the big iron mines, empty because of two world wars, all of that iron being used to fight world wars. Okay, so at any rate, the point of the food discussion is that the world is headed into a severe food shortage. And that's why, as long as I can, I will continue to put the Mountain House cases as they become available, so people will have something in reserve, because I'm seeing the day, just like it happened in England, if there is a emergency of some kind, whether it's man-made, whether it's political, whether it's a war, whether it's a natural event, from earth-based events or from something coming by or whatever from outer space, people are going to they have to take care of themselves. They have to have fresh water. They have to have some food. The flax, by the way, is still available on the webpage. I encourage everybody to have at least one case of flax per person per year in stock. And by the way, these are things that you should use every day, and keep them in stock, the flax, the water filter, etc. But all of that on the home page, the secure web ordering page. I put them there. They, of course, help support this show, but also these are the things you need. You absolutely need these things in case of emergency. I've encountered a few, every week I encounter new people that are starting to wake up and go, you know, I've been thinking about this, but I just didn't know what to do or didn't really have a direction. And all of a sudden they wake up and they have to, they realize they have to prepare. Preparedness is very simple. And the relief that it gives you once you are prepared, only the people who have prepared really understand the relief, knowing that you have the ability to take care of yourself. Remember, once something happens, you can't go and call up and order it then. You can't go down to the corner store because it's going to be empty and you're not going to be able to go get gasoline. All of the things that you commonly depend upon will not be there. So you have to be prepared, and you have to stay where you are, and you have to have your resources available. And you have to know how to use them. Your water filter should be used every day. Your food supply, you should use it every day to understand how it works so your body adjusts to eating it. It should be part of your daily, and by the way, it's very healthy. If you live like that, you will be very healthy. Okay, well, I'm going to turn directions now and talk about the rock layers up by Niagara Falls. Now, here's the history. If we go back to what is called the Silurian period in history, this runs from about 443 million years ago to around 417 million years ago. So that's about a 36-year period, and a 26-year period. I'm sorry, my math is a little short today. So about a 26-million-year period, and here's what the geological history shows. There was a vast mountain range where the Appalachian, the Catskill, and the Allegheny Mountains exist. There was a vast mountain range, and in modern terms, we call it the Taconic Mountains. It was a mountain range much, much bigger than the Rocky Mountains. A tremendous mountain range that covered that area. Imagine the eastern Appalachians, the Catskills, the Alleghenies Mountains. Okay, and this immense mountain range over millions and millions of years eroded away to the west, where we now see Pennsylvania, where we now see New York State, upstate New York, moving out into the western states to Michigan. There was a vast, shallow, kind of a swamp-like ocean. And so what happened with the rains, the sediment off the mountains, washed off the Taconic Mountains and off into this vast, shallow ocean, setting up layers and layers. This eventually turned into a very hard type of rock called dolomite. Extremely hard. So when you see the water rushing over the Niagara Falls, and there's that ledge, that very hard layer ledge that the water comes rushing over, one might think, well, gee, that should erode away and just overnight. But it's extremely, extremely hard rock that was laid down sedimentary of runoff and silt from the Taconic Mountains that then layered up into that shallow ocean that in that area of New York State, southern Ontario, Michigan, that whole area, this vast shallow ocean existed. And so then, but here's the thing. If you look at the rock in this area, about every 4 or 5 inches, about every 4 inches of this gray dolomite rock, all of a sudden there's a very thin shale layer. Now, shale is a black, kind of a charcoal black colored rock, very thin in this case, and very soft. It's very soft, where the dolomite is an extremely hard layer. And so what is shale? Where does it come from? It's a clay composition, and that clay typically comes from volcanic activity. Now, I counted in some of the rock there, I counted as many as 10 layers of dolomite shale, dolomite shale, dolomite shale, and these are successive layers that occurred, and so at very even periods throughout this 26 million period during the what is known as Silurian period, the stratigraphy, as it is called, or the layering of rock, this occurred over millions and millions of years. Excuse me. So what was the spacing between these layers? Well, one could estimate, just say roughly 1 to 2 million years per layer. And then all of a sudden, a very thin layer of shale, and then another couple million years of dolomite, and then another very thin layer of shale. Something is going on here, or was going on a very regular basis back then. At every transition, the life forms changed radically in many cases. Sometimes fish made a jump in evolution. Sometimes the small shell animals made a jump in evolution. But at these transition layers, at the transition layers of shale and clay, which is a result of volcanic activity, there was a radical change in life on Earth, an extinction which was coupled with a very, very rapid change in the species. So these were mass extinctions, change in species, and it was worldwide in scope. It covered vast areas on a very regular basis. Now, standard science might say, oh, well, an asteroid crashed into Earth. Well, asteroids don't crash into Earth on 2 million-year cycles. That's just, you know, you could maybe explain one layer like that, but to have even layers that are exactly and almost exactly the same distance apart, a couple inches of dolomite, a layer of shale, four more inches of dolomite, a layer of shale, four more inches of dolomite, another layer of shale, on and on for, as I said, about a 26 million year period. Very interesting. So what was going on? This brings us back to our friend Planet X. Now, people in the modern world, talking about Planet X, talk about a 3,600 year period. And as I've said before, I don't believe the 3,600 year cycle, because we have a history going back 3,600 years. And what happened in that time frame is a comet that we now call the planet Venus, the nucleus of that huge comet that was captured by Jupiter, worked its way through the solar system. And there again, my books explain how a large comet can become a planet by the tail drag. The tail drag slows down the comet nucleus. It pulls against it. As the electrical forces pull the comet tail into the nucleus, that also pulls back on the comet nucleus and causes the orbit of the nucleus to spiral in, so to speak, to become closer to the sun. And then with a couple gravitational encounters with Jupiter, with Mars, with Earth, that's what allowed Venus to settle into the orbit that it has today. Even the ancient Mayan myths that go back thousands of years talks about the heart of Quetzalcoatl, which was the giant serpent of the night sky. In all of the ancient cultures, the Chinese have the dragon, all of the ancient cultures from around the world have some personification of the giant comets which ruled the sky at one time. But that particular comet became the planet Venus. So that was about 3,600 years ago. Since Venus became a planet, it's not going to be Planet X coming back in 3,600 years, if you see what I mean. So the time frame is off. People are mixing events, and they don't understand it. They don't understand that the 3,600 year period, that 3,600 years ago was for what became the planet Venus. But planet Venus probably came in as part of a bigger entourage, possibly, possibly not. But within the past 10,000 years, we have definitely had other visitors. The Colbran is very, very specific about this. So at any rate, that, if you want to talk about a Planet X object, there is evidence. The Catholic Church, the Old Testament, all of these, there's ample evidence that there is some type of cyclic Planet X type object that comes in on a, let's call it a 5,000 year orbit, just to be a round number. It's more than 3,600, it's probably less than 10,000 year cycle. But there are many, many more. The question I'm posing here is, at the time of the Silurian period, there appears to have been an object that came in and that was on about a 2 million year period and caused the volcanoes of the Earth to explode for a period of time, causing the thin shale layer. Maybe it was the volcano at Yellowstone going off on a very regular basis. Could this have been just the volcano at Yellowstone going off? Or was there something else causing it on a regular basis? See what I'm saying? It's very, very difficult to understand all of the events that were going on in the world. The thing about those epochs, though, the changes in life forms at the boundaries, the shale boundaries, was worldwide. It was not just New York. It was not just the area around Niagara Falls. So it was something worldwide, which points to the probability that something indeed was coming in on a possible 1 to 2 million year basis. But then it stopped. It stopped. It didn't continue. So what happened? Could that have been possibly when the planet Saturn was adopted into the solar system? That's just a hypothetical possibility. I'm not saying that it did, but all of the planets eventually were captured into the solar system. At later dates, Jupiter and the Sun being the original twin star pair. So at any rate, the point is that possibly one of the major planets that we now see in the solar system was something that was maybe on a couple million year orbit. Could there be other planets out there, big planets, that are in similar orbits? They could come in from any direction, they could come in at any time, and possibly on orbits anywhere from 10,000 years to 10 million years. We don't know. We don't have that data. And the scientific community has a two-pronged approach to this entire problem. First of all, they're looking desperately for these types of objects. NASA just announced that it is looking for these types of objects, brown dwarf types of objects. It has many programs looking for these types of objects. And it claims that it has found some. But they're not really talking about what they have found. What are the orbits? Most of these would probably be benign orbits. They're orbits that would not affect Earth in any way, shape, or form. So that is one issue, but if there are big ones out there, and if there's enough of them, some of them very potentially could have orbits that would come in and affect the solar system. Could there be a planet out there that only comes in on a 100 million year orbit? Could there be one on a 100,000 year orbit? How do you sort it out? How do you understand which planet is which? One of the biggest aspects of the misinformation campaign to get people to dissuade people from understanding the concept of Planet X is that there's just one of them. What bigger piece of misinformation could you possibly have than to mislead the public into thinking there is only one Planet X and have all of the internet hype, etc., concentrating around one Planet X? And see, now that was the heart of the misinformation campaign, the 2003 May 15th Crazy Lady Talks to Aliens, that Planet X was supposed to come and destroy the world on May 15th, 2003, and some lady talks to aliens and predicted it, and it was just as crazy a story as it could be. But what message would that send to everybody, including talk show hosts, including the scientific community? Oh, that's just those crazy Planet X people that think they talk to aliens. So at any rate, I'm running out of time here. But be sure to go to the web page. As I said, the food is available there. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.